Hello and welcome back to another edition of Podcasts from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. I've always said these podcasts are my way of asking questions I genuinely don't know the answer to, but to look as if I might be doing a public service at the same time. Lately, we've been talking about energy and climate change and how South Africa is going to respond to it all. To say we're all over the place is putting it mildly. On paper, there's the Integrated Resource Plan of 2019. That's supposed to be our energy Bible, but it seems to be already out of date, making assumptions that can't be met, like getting hydropower from the Congo River, or changing assumptions altogether. The IRP makes relatively little provision for gas, and suddenly gas is on everyone's lips. What is clear is that the so-called just transition, the design and pace of the transition to carbon neutrality from coal-fired power stations as we have now, in order to protect coal jobs and the black business elite that's moved into coal as traditional miners have abandoned it, that's up for grabs, this transition. And so what is just, what do we mean by just here, actually? A slow process, one that gets us across the line and operating properly as soon as possible. My guest today sort of owns a large part of the answer. He's an expert in energy storage, amongst many other things. He's modeled it, and I can't wait for you to listen to him. Clyde Mallinson is an independent energy analyst, and Clyde, thank you so much for your time. Could I start by asking you why storage hardly appears to feature at all in the IRP? Let me just quickly tell people where we are. So in the IRP, current storage is regarded as 3,000 megawatts, and we know that's hydro storage, that's water. They add another 513 megawatts this year, which I'm not sure is happening, and a further 1,500 megawatts in 2029. That's not a lot. Why are they not planned for more storage, Clyde?
Hi, morning, Peter. Great to be on this cast, and thanks for that kickoff question. Well, the answer is that for a long time, the designers of the system and the people looking at adequacy have put a lot of faith in the fact that the coal fleet will operate as it should operate, and that the new members of the coal fleet will operate as one would like them to. And that, quite frankly, we don't need, in the eyes of the IRP, we don't need that much storage. And, of course, storage for a long time has been very expensive. So, generally speaking, even when the CSIR looked at modeling not that long ago, there wasn't a large amount of storage because we are still so dominated by coal, by nuclear, that the need for storage wasn't foreseen in the way that we are going to need it. So what I actually like doing is looking what the situation will be like when we no longer have a coal fleet and when we no longer have a nuclear fleet. I think that's a really good point to start at, is to say how much storage will we need when we are fully decarbonized and we are operating our system virtually entirely on wind and solar. And that's a good point that I like to start at.
Well, go on. Please answer that question because it's the next obvious one. How much will we need?
Right. So my calculations show that we will need somewhere between 5 to 10 times as much storage as what they have put in the IRP 2019 by 2030. And that by 2040, more or less, let's use 2040 as a date when the coal fleet is completely retired and where the nuclear fleet is completely retired, although the nuclear fleet will be completely retired by mid-2020s, basically, if it doesn't get life extended. Then we'll need approximately 35 gigawatts of storage of 8-hour duration. So you correctly said we currently have approximately 3 in pump storage. So we will need more than 10 times as much storage.
By when, Clark?
By 2040.
Okay.
Assuming 2040 is the date by when we have completely retired the coal fleet. And also, and this is quite a big assumption, but it's an easy one to understand, assuming we just use the same amount of electricity as we currently do. So it actually becomes quite nuanced because we need a quantum of storage that can meet our peak load. And our peak load at the moment is somewhere around about 35 gigawatts. So we need storage that can deliver 35 gigawatts. Generally in the early evening when the sun's obviously not shining, and assuming that none of the wind sites in the whole country are generating anything, our minimum storage size in terms of capacity needs to equal our current evening peak load, which is about 35. So that sets an easy to understand limit. If you're going to at some point use 35 and you haven't, and you've only got wind and solar and storage, your storage needs to be at least 35.
So that's the sort of cataclysmic view of it. In other words, there's never any wind at 5:30 in the afternoon. The sun has gone down. And there's nothing. So, right, there's no base load. There's no more coal left. Coburg, was never recommissioned. It never, so that's the worst case, or the best case, depending on where you stand.
Yeah, what's particularly interesting is that the big mistake we make, or I believe it's a mistake that's made, is that we look at peak load and we say, okay, by 2040, our peak's going to be at the same time and it's going to be bigger than it is now. And that's, in fact, by 2040, our peak will be in the middle of the day. We will be peaking demand in the middle of the day for the simple reason is that's when we'll be charging our batteries. We will have surplus solar in the middle of the day, and the battery, when it's in charging mode, is actually a demand center. And so it's actually more important to size the battery at a size that it's big enough to be able to soak up the excess solar that's happening at midday and charge up the battery. So, in fact, it's more important that the battery's of a size that's big enough to be able to put as much of that surplus into it as is possible. And so it's kind of like it's not so much trying to cover the peak anymore. It's trying to be big enough to be able to take the excess that's coming at midday. And so our peak will be at midday in future, and our trough will still probably be at around about midnight to 2 o'clock in the morning. We'll have a totally different demand profile. And that's something I think people don't fully appreciate. They kind of just extrapolate the current demand profile forward. It'll be completely different.
But so what happens when you can see, when people talk about energy in the future, you can see how frightened they are, because they're frightened to let go of this notion of baseload, that there has to be something that is always producing electricity nonstop, not just passively holding on to it, but always and without stop being able to produce it. So it's either a nuclear plant or a coal plant. What is the leap of faith that those people need to make, that you make?
Yeah, if you want to stick with the base load, you know, the definition of base load has nothing to do with generation. It's literally the load profile, the lowest point of the load profile is by definition the base point of the load. And the question then is, how do you meet not just the base point of the load, but how do you meet all of the load? And traditionally, people have said, well, we never drop below a certain base level of load, and therefore we need base generation, if you like, to meet base load. But of course, base load isn't when we normally have our problem. It's everything above the base of the load that causes our problem. And normally we battle to supply at peak times. We can generally provide enough electricity to meet our so-called base load. And so the terms have been mixed together, and I prefer to talk about things as base generation, or generation that needs to run consistently 24/7 if possible to be most efficient. And typically that's nuclear and coal. Coal doesn't like to be switched on and off. Nuclear can't be switched on and off. You know, the reactions take place. I mean, you obviously can switch off the power output from Coburg, but you can't switch off the radioactive decay of the uranium in the reactors. It's happening all the time. So, what we misunderstand is that we don't just need to meet our so-called base point of the load. We need to meet our full load with different generation technologies. And that perhaps the most difficult part for the incumbents to understand is that if we swept away all of the coal fleet, and I don't mean just ditched it, but if we could imagine that it was gone, tomorrow and the nuclear fleet, we can then very easily calculate what is the least cost replacement. In other words, how much wind, how much solar, and how much storage should we build to be able to have full security of supply, which will deliver at base load levels, but also deliver throughout the whole load? What is the cheapest mix we can build? And it turns out we can either build slightly less wind and solar. We obviously have enough. We have to build enough to be able to cover our needs. And then we build huge batteries. And we say, gee, we're even going to store some of the excess in summer and use it in winter. And that's where some countries run into interseasonal problems. In South Africa, we don't have that problem. We tend to have not as big a disconnect between summer and winter. So what becomes cheaper then is to build more wind and solar and have smaller batteries or less storage. And if you do that, you end up with the cheapest possible capital cost mix of what you build. And if we do that, you de facto have surpluses of wind and solar for most of the year, because you design a system that can give you absolute security of supply on the worst patch in winter, when there's fewer hours of sunshine. And if you can get through that worst patch of winter securely, it de facto means that you have surpluses of wind and solar for the rest of the year. And that's really the problem with incumbent utilities. They don't like surpluses because they think surpluses need to be curtailed. I mean, anyone can see it would be ludicrous to be running a coal plant and generating a surplus of electricity and then burning the coal, but cutting off the generator, so to speak. It just doesn't make sense. But in the case of variable renewable resources, it makes complete sense to overbuild wind and solar, put in fewer batteries, but still enough to give you security of supply. You get your cheapest price point. And that's the basis of it. So if you want to worry about the so-called what can supply absolutely, then of course the batteries can. We're going to have 35 gigawatts of batteries. So those batteries will be able to supply almost 20 times as much as what Coburg supplies with absolute surety for at least 8 hours. And that's basically saying that we will be at peak for a full 8 hours. And when you look at our wind and solar complementary resources, we never have to do that. We would never have to run for a full 8 hours at peak load, just by definition, because peak load happens at 7 in the evening. In the middle of the night, our peak load is perhaps 16 gigawatts. So it would never happen. And when you model it, you make sure that the combination of wind and solar and storage is able to deliver not the base load, the full load, with absolute reliability for the whole year.
So this is, I mean, that's absolutely fascinating, and I'm glad you said all of that. I wanted to ask you a question that occurred to me as I was reading. There was a very good energy supplement in Business Day late last week, and one of the editors, Colin Anthony, suggests that instead of really messing around, you know, we have an idea of what we're short of, and you can see it when load shedding occurs. You know, what is the argument against doing the following, as he suggests? Decide what the shortage is. Let's say it's 10,000 megawatts or 5,000 megawatts or whatever it might be, and simply increase the next renewables bid window to fill that shortage. And I wanted to add to something. So what he means, I suspect, is fill it with 5,000 megawatts of wind and solar. But if every project like that, the wind and solar project, included battery storage, would that fundamentally change the game? Could that be done, or does it make the whole project too expensive? Why do we build wind and solar without batteries? The batteries, presumably, Clyde, already exist.
Yes, look, storage technology has dropped in cost by 90% in the last decade, and it's due to drop by another 80% in the next decade, more or less. So it's come down hugely, more so than any other technology. And although one could argue now there's a bit of a spike with prices of lithium and nickel and cobalt, well, there's also a bit of a spike in fossil fuels at the moment. So those two arguments, if you like, cancel each other out to a certain extent. I think what's going to be faster than necessarily trying to design a procurement process that insists on complementary storage is to actually allow the private sector to build and to supply to private clients from private PPAs as quickly as possible. Because we tried to have a so-called emergency risk mitigation procurement program, and it tried to say you had to be able to deliver from 5 o'clock in the morning to 9:30, and the people who managed to do that with renewables put in inordinate amounts of storage. And if you remember what I said earlier, you can either build a huge amount of storage to try and give you the so-called mythical baseload between bookends from 5 in the morning to 9:30 at night, or you can just inject that extra energy into the system. And I can tell you right now that Eskom currently, its biggest problem is it doesn't have enough energy in the system to make use of its existing storage. We're actually very fortunate in that we have a great big 3 gigawatts of existing storage with 20 hours of capacity, and we're having to shed load at night in order to fill the pump storage dams. In other words, we're short of energy. So if we put 5 gigawatts,
we're load shedding in order to fill up the storage.
Correct. And we load shedding in order to allow diesel resources to be replenished in the diesel storage tanks. Think of diesel in a sense also as storage, because the diesel is stored in tanks, and the open cycle gas turbines that run on diesel can only run for as long as there's diesel in the storage tanks. And I think it was possibly Jan Oberholzer who said, we can't run our open cycle gas turbines on diesel 24/7. We run out of diesel. We can't get the diesel trucks to Ankerlich and Goritza and the other points fast enough to be able to keep those things running. So they have 2 weeks of storage built in, but the 2 weeks of storage is meant to be sufficient if those facilities are only being used for 3-4 hours a day. In other words, you're running at peak times with the OCGTs. Now, if you're running those open cycle gas turbines for even 12 hours a day, your 2 weeks suddenly becomes 4 days. So when Eskom put out load shedding notices, they always say, not always, but most of the time they say, we're running low on reserve margin. And that's code, if you like. It's not code. Reserve margin means water in the upper dams on the pump storage schemes and diesel in the diesel tanks.
So basically, we know that there's a crisis and there's an emergency. The current powers that be, the establishment, let's say, the elite business, government, Eskom, they're all looking at how to solve this via a transition, right? They like to call it a just transition, and it's all for the workers. Of course, it's not for the workers. It's for the companies. It's for the coal suppliers, who now turn out to be large constituents of the ANC, who are saying, hang on, we've just bought these resources. You can't shut us down. Anyway, whatever the case may be, we have a situation where they want to, instead of just going straight wind and solar and doing what you suggest they do, we're going to take an extra 20-year chunk out of our economy or out of our lives and find something to transition with, and it's going to be gas. I don't know whether you've looked at the National Business Initiative, the NBI report, about 2 weeks ago. This is a Sasol-led initiative, but there are a lot of heavyweight signatures on it, which suggests that, no, we can build infrastructure in South Africa between 2030 and 2035 to fill the gap with gas, with LNG brought to our shores in ships. This is not Guedemantache's car power ships solution. It's something else. We can feed the gas into perhaps some of Eskom's current diesel-fired gas turbines, or we could put, you know, we can actually create some energy plant, gas-fired energy plant, coast of the sea, and it would not, in the end, it wouldn't end up as a sort of stranded asset, you know, that it would be okay, it wouldn't be spending too much money. But I wanted to ask you, though, I mean, we could, if we put our backs into it, we could solve this thing now. I mean, we could, in terms of wind and solar and batteries, we could go for it. We know how much we need. We could start tomorrow, surely.
Correct. Once one needs to understand, we're not talking about sweeping the coal-fired power stations away overnight. There is a transition, and the transition really is to rationally get as much as we can out of the coal fleet. And when I say as much as we can, we basically need to build the new wind and solar and storage in order to create the headroom to enable us to shut down the coal fleet and the coal mining associated with the coal fleet in an ordinary fashion. So instead of the coal fleet auto-retiring itself and us then scrambling to fill the gaps, we need to have a build program that creates headroom that allows us then in a rational fashion to retire the coal fleet. That's really the one point. And I also just want to mention that storage is not restricted to battery storage. I think there are opportunities for more pumped hydro storage. I think Eskom themselves have got some opportunities there. I think there's a pumped hydro scheme that was in the making in Limpopo province near Steelport Valley. And then, of course, something that most people aren't aware of, all or many of our old gold mines have got still today are pumping water out. And those gold mines basically are water storage devices of note. So we have chambers in dolomitic chambers in the gold mines that sit near the surface. And that water then percolates down to the bottom and has to be pumped out even if the dam, even if the mine is closed. So there's an opportunity to build pumped hydro storage in old gold mines and in fact existing gold mines where you wouldn't have to civilly construct brand new dams. You've basically got underwater dams at different levels that could be utilized.
You generate the electricity by pumping the water into the dam, and it as it falls into the mine, it would turn a turbine. Is that right?
No, you would pump up from a lower level of the dam to of underground to a higher level when you've got surplus electricity. So it's in the middle of the day, the sun's shining, you're generating more than we're using. You would pump to an upper reservoir underground. And then at night or at peak time in the evening, you would drop it from that upper reservoir through a thing called a penstock. It's basically just a tunnel. And in that tunnel sits a turbine. And that turbine, it's basically a pumped hydro scheme. But I don't know if you realize the amount of water on the far west rand in those gold mines that have dolomite overlying them equals something like 15 times the amount of water stored in the Vaal Dam sitting underground. So the other advantage is it doesn't evaporate. And we're having to pump it anyway all of the time to stop the levels filling up and leading to acid mine drainage. So that's just one example. Another would be we can take old mine dumps and turn them into gravity masses and then lift and lower big chunks of old mine dump, if you like, that are put into blocks. And that becomes a form of gravity storage. So I just want to just get the point home that energy storage systems are not all or only battery energy storage systems. There's a range of energy storage solutions.
Yes, no, I understand perfectly. But come back to batteries for a moment. How sophisticated are they, and what will batteries look like, not only in cost terms, but what will they look like in size terms, I guess, and technology? Because we're still talking about old-style batteries. These are lithium-ion batteries where, you know, they've got liquid in them. What about, you know, will solid-state batteries ever make a presence felt? And what, but even if they don't, what do, what does current battery technology look like in a decade?
Okay, well, even already, you can fit 2 megawatt hours into a single 12-meter container. So if you wanted 100 megawatt hours, you would require about 50 containers. Now, to put that into perspective, a solar farm, or for that matter, a coal mine, a single solar farm or a single coal mine would probably represent enough space to build, you know, 50% of the batteries we need in terms of space requirements. So basically, if you're looking at relatively small, you stick with containers because that's quick. It can be installed quickly. If you're going really big, you probably build a purpose-built building that would house the batteries, and there would be no need to containerize it. And those things are measured in hectares, not thousands of hectares or hundreds of hectares even. In a single hectare, you can place a very large battery. And the nice thing about batteries is that it's best to actually spread them around a bit. So instead of having one, you don't have to think of it in terms of like pump storage where you've got a dam on Van Rienen's Pass. You can say instead of building one big storage facility, we can place the storage at each of the substations, for example, in Johannesburg. And so now the battery, interestingly enough, energy storage is most valuable in the hands of the system operator. Because it's not just for backup for load shedding. It's basically used to charge up when you've got surpluses and to discharge when you've got shortages. But it also massively increases the utility of your grid. You can imagine now in the Northern Cape, we've got lots of solar and it's kind of maxed out. We can't put more solar in because the transmission network coming out of it can't carry it. But you can imagine just very easily, if one put battery storage in the Northern Cape, you could put double the amount of solar. You could be exporting the solar. The other half you could be putting into the battery, and you could then export that other half from the Northern Cape on the same transmission lines as you're currently exporting, and you could double the output or double the carrying capacity from the Northern Cape. But just going back to your question on gas, because it's important, the bulk of the modeling that's been done, even with fewer resources of storage than what I would advocate, indicates that if we're going to use gas at all, it's going to represent maybe 1% of our annual output. And the people who are advocating for gas, in particular combined cycle gas turbines, are saying, who's going to ever want to look for new gas fields off South Africa if we're only going to generate 1 terawatt hour a year from the gas? So they're pressing for an anchor offtake tenant, if you like, in the power sector. And they're saying, we want you to run at least 60% of the time so that we can say, gee, this new combined cycle gas turbine is going to need X amount of gas. Now it can incentivize gas exploration companies to go and look for the stuff because they can say, oh, we've got ourselves an anchor tenant for our shopping center, so to speak. And all of the studies show that we don't need an anchor tenant. These cheaper ways of producing electricity than running gas on a combined cycle basis. And looking to replace a 3-gigawatt coal plant with, for example, a 3-gigawatt gas plant is looking to replace old with old.
Yeah.
If you look at the economies in the world that already have a sophisticated gas infrastructure, upstream infrastructure, everything, they're actually turning away from gas. You know, I think not everywhere, but certainly in California and many of the states in America, you no longer are allowed to do new building developments and put in gas infrastructure for piping of gas to those places. So they actually backpedaling out of gas at a very time when, I don't know, sometimes we feel we have to follow global trends, and because the rest of the world was allowed to use gas, we have to use gas, although we don't have any at the moment. And I always smile at this because it's almost like saying, well, the rest of the world used, celluloid photography. Imagine if we had never had any cameras in South Africa and we then had digital cameras and someone said, well, we've got to have our turn to use the good old Agfa and Kodak cameras.
Yes.
It's just ludicrous.
We want a just transition for photography.
Exactly. I mean, it's just crazy. So, yeah.
You mentioned when we spoke the other day that there was a way that people could become more involved in this new era, this new energy future of ours. That storage was something that could, you know, what we do in South Africa now is we collect taxes and we give them away to poor people simply to keep them quiet, basically, so that they don't rise up against, you know, those of us who have jobs or whatever it might be. But there must be a better way to involve people in the future and in their economy. And you had some thoughts about how a renewables future, storage, solar and wind, could really be an inclusive one in a meaningful way.
Peter, to me, that's the essence of a so-called just transition. A just transition obviously includes the livelihoods of people working on the coal fleet and people involved in coal mining. And that base is covered because the amount of jobs that will be created will far exceed the number of jobs that are lost. And there's any number of studies done by reputable institutions, the CSIR, there's a whole lot that have looked at the job. So that's, take that as a given. I'm more interested in closing the Gini index in South Africa, taking us from that dreadful worst position in the world in terms of inequality. And perhaps the best way to explain it is to say that investing in this new fleet is what I call pension fund heaven. The fleet, if we build it and sell electricity from it, either to private clients or to Eskom or whatever it may be, we can sell electricity at the factory gate of a fleet that comprises wind, solar, and storage at a considerable discount to what we are currently have to pay, what we currently are paying for factory gate Eskom electricity. And you understand what I mean by factory gate.
I don't. So
we're talking prior to delivery.
Okay.
So we're just talking at the generation at the factory gate prior to delivery. We can do it at a significant discount. The discount with the new price increases is probably 50%. We can produce factory gate electricity at half the cost of what Eskom are currently producing factory gate electricity at. Now, at that price point, whoever builds and owns the solar plant, the storage facility, the wind facility, that facility can be funded, for example, with pension fund money. Let's just start with pension fund. We all kind of understand what pension fund money is. And we're not talking here about taking government employees' pension funds and bailing out Eskom debt. We're talking about investing it in this new fleet. The new fleet, at those price points that I've indicated, that will save us that large amount of money, will be able to deliver dividends to the pension fund beneficiaries that are better than the last 10-year average of what they've received, whether it's the Eskom pension fund or Allan Gray or Old Mutual or Sanlam. You can deliver dividends on a pension fund investment from renewable energy that would basically put pension fund investment managers out of business because they wouldn't have to think anymore about where to invest their portfolio. So taking that as a point of departure, and someone could say, Clyde, you're crazy. That's not the case. I'll say, okay, so instead of saving 60 cents a kilowatt hour, we can save 50 cents and add another cent, another 10 cents to the pension fund investment. Now it's going to be returning 10% real instead of 8% real, you know, how high do you want it to be? Because we've still got another 50 cents in the bag. You can actually almost socially engineer the return on the pension fund. Now, recognizing that that will impact on people who are lucky enough to have pension funds, in other words, people who have jobs, you can start saying, well, what about the jobless? They haven't got pension funds. So how are they going to benefit? And the answer is, just to give you an actual tangible amount, and I'm not saying this is that people will do this, but I want to illustrate it as an option. Let's say that a commercial bank lends an unemployed person who happens to own an RDP house, 100,000 rand, as a bond against that house. Knowing full well that that person has very little chance of being able to pay back that bond. But let's also say that they give them that bond at the lowest possible interest rate, not the highest. In other words, they give that bond at a prime minus, the same way they would give it to someone living on Beachy Head in Blettenburg Bay at prime minus. But they do that on condition that the homeowner purchases a green bond with that money. And that green bond will specifically be to build a solar plant or a wind plant or a storage facility, preferably in the district where they hail from. The dividends that they would receive from that bond ownership would be sufficient to repatriate the bond that they had taken from a commercial bank. In fact, over 20 years, it would not just repatriate the bond that they had taken. It would do so 2.5-fold. So if they had borrowed 100,000, they would earn back 250,000 over the period of a bond. Now, the interesting thing there is that's before one places any green value on this. It's before one says, well, what's the carbon tax? This is just pure economics. So now we know carbon taxes are coming. We know that the world is itching to offer very, very low interest rates to countries who can reduce their carbon footprint. So what I'm saying is that the $8 billion that has come in for accelerating the decommissioning of the coal fleet, if perhaps $1 billion of that $8 billion was used to underwrite collateral for people who don't have collateral, to enable them to borrow the 100,000 from the commercial banks, buy a stake in a solar or wind or storage facility in their district, know that they have an ownership in that. They can drive past it on their bicycle, ride past it and say, those solar panels belong to me. The idea would be that I've modeled it, and within 15 years, especially if one can monetize the green value of what we're talking about, but even if one can't, within 15 years, the dividends received from that green bond will equal about half of what a current SASSA grant is, if we stick to that 100,000 number, and it will be 3 to 4 times as much as a COVID relief bond. And so the idea would be that this new fleet would be owned by 10 million South Africans who have been excluded from the bond markets previously.
That's a fantastic point to end this conversation on, Clyde. Thank you very, very much for an extremely enriching conversation. And I hope listeners enjoyed it as much as I did. I'll be back next week for the last of our climate change conversations for a while. Don't miss it, and take care of yourselves until then.